Here at the Pennsylvania Game Commission, our passion is wild. Tune in to our podcast, Call of the Outdoors, as we discuss all things related to wildlife, hunting, habitat, and conservation across the Keystone State. Hear from men and women who have a passion for the outdoors and who value and work to preserve our state's wildlife resources for current and future generations.
Hello and welcome to Call of the Outdoors, the podcast of the Pennsylvania Game Commission. Let me tell you something. We're cold right now. You know, it's that time of year, but it's also a time of year to talk about something that's really important. And let me tell you, we're going to get down to some nitty-gritty on the waterfowl program here in Pennsylvania, because today's guest is Nate Huck. You know, if you think about that last name, there's a famous fishing company, and Nate used to own that company. Now he's working for us here at the Pennsylvania Game Commission. I'm joking about that company. But, Nate, welcome this morning to Call the Outdoors, and thanks for coming on bright and early this morning.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Heck yeah. But from our little conversation, this isn't even cold to you. I mean, where you're from, Wisconsin, correct?
Yeah. Yep.
I mean, this is t-shirt weather. 11 degrees, you don't even get a jacket on yet, right?
Yeah. I mean, I put a jacket on this morning, but yeah, it's nice. It's not windy. So yeah, I'm originally from Wisconsin. So born and raised there, did my undergrad there. And then I went to Texas A&M Kingsville. So I got the taste of the real deep South.
Man, that's like cultured. That's way culture different from... Now, were you in Madison? Is that where you went to school?
No, I went to Stevens Point.
Oh, okay.
So, yep.
Okay.
Yep. And then, A&M King... Yeah, that was a culture shock for sure. Yeah, quite a bit different. It was interesting to walk into Walmart and have a hurricane preparedness center, you know.
Sure. And they probably didn't really understand your accent in Kingsville at first, right?
Yeah, I got some accent comments, but yeah.
I'm sure. So a little bit, you know, you gave us a little background, Nate. Let's just talk about, you know, you are our waterfowl biologist or waterfowl program specialist. And, you know, a lot of folks don't realize the passion that here at the Game Commission. I know that you're a avid hunter out there and, you know, from your area to now here in Pennsylvania and, you know, obviously different flyways. We're going to talk about all that stuff, but just tell us a little bit about your background, even as a kid growing up and why you're sitting here today here at the Pennsylvania Game Commission.
Yeah. Like I said, grew up in Wisconsin. My dad was a really avid hunter, actually grew up more on deer than anything else. I think, you know, a lot of people in PA can relate to that.
Wisconsin's really similar to us, except for that big river that goes down one side of it that's obviously a huge flyway and waterfowl.
Yeah, yeah. I was actually on the eastern side of the state, but as I got a little into high school and then into college, I really got into waterfowl, and I did one of my spring breaks. I went down to the Mississippi River in Keokuk, Iowa, and banded, you know, we caught 7,000 scop in 7 days. And from then on, I was like, I'm going to handle more ducks as a waterfowl biologist than a deer biologist is ever going to handle. And so from there on, I switched over to interest in waterfowl. And then, yeah, I jumped up, went down to Texas and did some research on northern pintails. And then, I got my first real job with Wyoming Game and Fish as their migratory game bird biologist. And after 4 years there, I came here. So
we were talking earlier, and you know, one of the tasks out there was sandhill cranes. And, you know, obviously the nickname they get is ribeye of the sky. And you said it's more like sirloin of the sky, right?
Yeah. Yeah. It just doesn't have quite the ring to it, you know.
I know it. So. I got you. But, you know, myself, I'm a little bit familiar with your area because I lived in Iowa for 7 years. I lived in Cedar Rapids and you say Keokuk, and I've been to Stevens Point, Wisconsin. And I mean, it's Wisconsin does remind me a lot of Pennsylvania as far as our tradition and our culture of hunters. I mean, if you grew up in Wisconsin, you're a deer hunter. It's just how it is. And, you know, it's very similar here in Pennsylvania. But, you know, let's talk about Pennsylvania as a waterfowl hunting state, because, you know, we don't necessarily always know where we stand, you know, especially new waterfowlers. That, you know, I'm way out of waterfowl lingo. I mean, there's flyways and this and that. So let's just talk about PA and, you know, what makes it so unique to folks or appealing to waterfowl hunters.
Yeah, it's a really diverse state in terms of waterfowl habitats. You know, we have that northern tier, you know, basically kind of excluding northwest PA, that It's mostly beaver ponds, small streams, some rivers.
We call Northwest PA Canada.
Yeah, well, you know, and I mean, obviously Northwest PA has some really amazing waterfowl hunting, all the wetlands, you know. It basically turns into a giant swamp up there. And then you have Lake Erie, which provides some really diverse hunting opportunities between the diver, particularly the diver hunting. That's what guys are up there for, really interested in. Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, you have the southern tier of PA that's, again, really diverse. We have some major river systems, including the Susquehanna, that, man, yeah, when it's good, it's really good. And then, you know, some of this southeast PA, south central PA farm country can be really, really good. You know, we're one of the top states in the Atlantic Flyway for Canada goose harvest. That's really our bread and butter. We shoot a lot of Canada geese, but we shoot quite a few mallards and we shoot quite a few wood ducks. That's the three that we really get after. And so,
to me, a wood duck is, there's nothing prettier than, you know, than a wood duck. That's my favorite duck just because it's so beautiful. And plus I like the way they sound, you know. It's, you know, it's kind of neat when I grew up, obviously turkeys are what I paid attention to, and you go to a sports show or whatever and people are blowing duck calls, and I always thought they were goofy and weird. And, you know, Tyler, I always tease him about waterfowl hunters, but in all honesty, I have a deep respect because it's a waterfowl hunters, you can see it in their eyes. I mean, it's a passion it's just like somebody that's really passionate about turkeys. But, you know, like you said, we are diverse, not only for ducks and geese and waterfowl, but all of our species. I mean, you look at deer and turkeys, and Pennsylvania is a neat place. It's not just one type of terrain, one type of habitat. And, you know, that makes your job even tougher because managing and you know, I want to get a little bit into, not day to day, but, you know, a lot of folks don't realize what a waterfowl biologist is tasked with. If you would, you know, take it in a, you know, 30,000 feet, it's obviously, we could sit here and talk about that for hours and hours. But like when you say waterfowl biologist, if you would, just for our folks listening, you know, exactly, you know, what are your main goals or main tasks throughout the year?
Sure. So this time of year, you know, it's January right now. We're kicking off our postseason banding period. So we have, you know, quotas of banding 600 plus mallards in the state. And we're also doing a really big transmitter project. So I'm kind of leading all those projects across the state. And then, we roll right into the season setting timeframe. So I'm working on season proposals and then we'll roll those out to the public. And then from there, you know, I lead all of the rest of our kind of our banding projects, whether that's, you know, Canada goose banding in June or our preseason banding period in August and September, as well as we have a waterfowl survey in April and May that I'm kind of heading up. And then, the rest of the year, I'm kind of focused in on our flyway communications with all the other states in the Atlantic Flyway. And, kind of digging into a little more of the science there, you know, analyzing that data and providing, all to just kind of kick back into, you know, our flyway season setting, which starts again in the fall.
Right. So. And, you know, a lot of folks that are out there, they don't realize how much work and how much time it takes to really, you know, when you're out there banding 600 ducks, there's a reason for it. I mean, it's not just so some duck hunter can put it on his call lanyard. I mean, let's talk about banding and why it's so important. And it's been going on a long time, not just, I mean, that's across the country. And obviously it's the best method for whether it's state or federal agencies to collect data, right?
Yeah, it's really, we've seen kind of a general paradigm shift slowly over the last maybe 20 years. That banding is becoming our most important tool. You know, we still have surveys. We have these long-going surveys, and those are still always going to be, you know, the greatest thing that we have because we can really measure trends. But we're slowly shifting toward using banding data, whether that be postseason banding data, which we can use to estimate annual survival of waterfowl, as well as our preseason banding data, which we can use for that annual survival estimate, but also for our harvest rate estimates. And then through some relatively simple math, we can actually estimate populations on the backside of that. So we can know how many birds were banded and how many birds were harvested, and we have a rough idea of how many birds were banded that were harvested. So
right, and that's what's real important out there for folks listening. That, you know, and I'm going to be real honest about myself. Like, I'd get a survey in the mail if I was in Florida or whatever, and I'd be like, I'll get to it later, and then eventually don't do it. It's so crucial for sportsmen, for hunters, for non-hunters. If you get a survey from our agency, from Pennsylvania Game Commission, and we beg you to fill it out, because what Nate just said about measuring trends and estimations of population, no matter what species it is, that is so important. And in today's world, we all have to work together. And the more cooperation that we get, the better the data we have, the better that your job or your task is to manage the resource. And as hunters, that's what we are. We're a tool. And I encourage everybody, instead of just throwing it away, if you get a survey or not answering the call, or if it's a simple email, take 3 minutes and fire your answers back, because the more information, the more data we collect, the better it is for the future of hunting, the better it is for the future of waterfowl, for that matter. But, you know, that's awesome, Nate. And I know you're busy. I see you periodically, and most of the time you have duck poop all over your pants or goose poop, and you spend a lot of time out there. And, like, we appreciate everything that you do to make Pennsylvania such a great place. But let's hit on that season-setting process, because I know – you know, obviously, in our bureau, we handle social media, and when things come out and people don't agree, you know, you're never going to please everybody. But there is you're not like pinning the tail on the donkey. You don't close your eyes and find. I mean, there's a reason the way things are done. And let's talk about what influences those decisions that are being made for future seasons.
Sure. So, yeah, season setting is really kind of like a two-tiered process, just generally speaking, for most states. Or I would guess for all states. We start at the flyway level, so we have a meeting in either August or September, and that's when we take all the data from the current year. So whether that be, so for, you know, for example, last August, September would have been 2021. We used all that information. We kind of make recommendations up to the higher-ups within the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and from there we kind of develop proposed season frameworks. And so those proposed season frameworks are coming out like right now, and then we will use those proposed season frameworks as well as hunter surveys, looking at general trends and migration and things like that to develop proposed seasons. And so from those proposed seasons, then we will roll those out to the public, and we'll look for public comment. And really, at that point in time, we've already gathered a lot of information from the public. We generally know what the public is looking for. What we're really looking for in those public comments is, did we miss something? You know, we're going to get, you know, last year we got over 100 comments in, and we never really saw huge general trends. We actually did make some adjustments. We moved the regular kind of that later split of the RP goose season a little bit later because the public really seemed to want that. But if we don't get tons and tons of comments on one specific thing, then we kind of usually stick with our proposed seasons. That doesn't mean we're not listening, but it.
Right. And that's one thing I will say about waterfowlers is that they are very in tune with communications back to the state agencies because, you know, they talk to us. Yep. And that's a great thing. And, you know, we're not going to always make the decision that suits you or me. We're making the best decision for the resource. And that's what, you know, so many times we have to take that into consideration. Like, yeah, we'd love for everybody to go out and get a limit every day, but that's not really feasible. I mean, we're not going to make the season to make that happen. I mean, that's just how it is. It's kind of like turkey season. Everybody's up in arms since I was a kid about, like, our season's way too late. It's way too late, but there's a reason that it's like that. And, you know, it's to make sure those hens get bred. And I'm not going to talk about turkeys and bore you anymore. It's just trying to relate. And right now it's kind of funny when I've seen the stress of the population across the country. A lot of states are having some turkey-related population issues. And the first thing that every one of them is doing is following our lead and backing that model, you know, backing that up, backing their season up to make sure those hens get a chance to mate. And it's kind of neat to see that we've been doing it right the whole time, you know, and what y'all do in science. I mean, you don't roll the dice. You have the data to make the decisions. I've watched that like I watch asking questions to anybody in your bureau, and I might ask some redneck off the wall question, and if there's no official data to back it up, we don't get an answer. I mean, and that's awesome. I mean, that's exactly what it is. And you know, the other part of waterfowling and waterfowl seasons, obviously, is the feds, the federal framework. And let's talk about, you know, how they affect our seasons here in Pennsylvania and our bag limits. And that's one that we probably should stick a little more time on, because a lot of folks don't realize that.
Yeah. Well, and I think myself included, I tend to blame the feds a lot, but we're pretty involved in that process.
Sure.
You know, and I mean, we're just as much to blame as they are.
I was trying to take some heat off you.
Yeah, no, I know. I appreciate that. But like, just to be totally honest. But yeah, I kind of mentioned that progression that happens, but to dig a little deeper into it, we have over time with the feds, the states all work together. We've developed various frameworks. So for example, right now we are in a liberal framework. A couple of years ago, we switched to basically what's called multi-stock management. So we look at the status of golden eyes. We look at the status of wood ducks. We look at the status of greenwing teal. And one of them is just completely leaving me right this second, but anyway, we look at all those stocks. It's ringnecks. I knew I'd get it. We look at the stocks of those four species, and we see how they're doing. And it's a kind of complicated little graph. It depends on how all each one's doing. And we end up in what we are right now with a liberal framework. So in a liberal framework, we get 60 days. Within Pennsylvania, since we have no Sunday hunting, we have compensatory days. So those allow us to roll over all those unused Sundays and still have 60 days of hunting.
That's pretty awesome. I mean, yeah. that's really, really awesome.
Yeah. It's nice. It'd be great if we could have Sunday hunting, but that's just my personal preference. I think there's actually a lot of waterfowl hunters that would probably not want to have that, but, yeah, it's pretty interesting. But, so yeah, we, from there, we also have between those 60 days, we also are only allowed because of, we actually have a grandfathered, zones and splits. And in our current zones and splits framework, we are only allowed the four zones that we have. We can't change those. If we change them, we have to go to what everybody else has to do. And we are only allowed one split. That's usually the biggest sticking point in our duck season setting, is that one split. Because, you know, we have, generally speaking, and everywhere except our Lake Erie zone, we have we have that early October season, and then we have our split, and then we open up again in October or in November. And so by having that, kind of kills our split. I know a lot of hunters are kind of pushing, they want to have the split during deer season. But if we have the split, then that means we're going to run that season directly from early mid October through, you know, Thanksgiving. Mm-hmm. And so you're going to lose quite a few days in there. Although there is some good migration timing, it's a real balancing act of dealing with some of those federal framework things.
It is. And as smart as y'all are and as good as y'all are, the man upstairs controls a lot when it comes to migrating waterfowl. And, you know, obviously like this year we're sitting in right now, like this is the first cold weather we have, and we're bouncing on February right now, you know, and we had ducks here, I'd imagine, just till a few days ago.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we had decent numbers, you know. I mean, it's really tough with these later seasons. I know there's a lot of guys that really want to see us push till the end of January. I mean, this year is a prime example. If there wouldn't be very many guys hunting next weekend if we were to close next weekend. You know, most guys would be froze out, whether they're fishing or they're hunting the river or they're hunting ponds, and I mean, they're going to be frozen. So it's there's definitely a few guys that have access to spots that are going to be probably pretty good.
You talked about splits, and I'm going to be honest with you. I mean, I've heard splits, and I mean, that's like saying duck to a waterfowl hunter. Explain the split in the split seasons and all that, when they use that term in waterfowling.
Sure. So a split is going to be a break in the season. So, you know, you have a 9-day season or a 16-day season, and then we have a break in that season. So otherwise you might have, you know, you could see how a state might run away with trying to use their 60 days to really lengthen that out. You know, they just close all the weekdays, right? Every Saturday, Sunday, you're open for for all hunting season. But instead, we only are allowed one split in the season. So you have that short, or you have a season, however long it is, 30 days, and then you can have a break. And that could mean 5 days. That could mean 20 days, 30 days. And then the season coming back in. So that would be the split.
And that's a federally mandated?
We're not required to have a split, but we are only allowed to have one split.
Okay. And some places can have multiple splits?
Yeah. So if you have, if your state only has one zone, or if it has two zones in the state, then you're allowed to have two splits in the season. If you have three zones, or in the case of like New York and PA, we have grandfathered in zones. So we actually have four and we're still allowed one split. And then most of the other states without grandfathered in zones, they can go to four zones, but then they can't have any splits in their season.
So it'd be just concurrent 60 days.
Yeah.
I got you. Okay. So basically, that's, there's a dice roll there. I mean, that can be a weather game but you're trying to make that, does that split change on an annual basis?
A little bit. It depends. You know, last year we made some changes. We try to kind of stick to a general season framework. Because weather can be so variable, we don't like to make changes every year or massive changes every year, because otherwise you're just chasing your tail after weather. You know, we want to kind of roll it out for 3, 4, or 5 years, see what happens before we make any significant changes.
Awesome. Well, that answered my question. And I'm sure there's a lot of folks out there that didn't understand that. And why are we grandfathered?
So we had that zones and splits. PA and New York, as an example, had four zones and splits when we actually started implementing regulations to control those zones and splits. I think there people saw some writing on the wall on where states might go with some of these things, so they started making these more standardized approaches to it.
Well, we're cool. We're just cool in Pennsylvania. I mean, especially when it comes to the hunting world. I mean, we do sell more hunting licenses in Wisconsin. So do you consider yourself a Pennsylvanian, or you still have that big W?
I've lived in so many states now, I don't even know if I have an affiliation.
You're a migrator. Yeah. Let's talk about something real quick, and we'll make this quick, because this has nothing to do with anything we're talking about. Ice fishing.
Yes, sir.
And I know that you have got to be a professional ice fisherman being from Wisconsin.
I do enjoy ice fishing.
It's a pastime, isn't it?
Yeah,
y'all are tough. I mean, and you have ice fishing towns. Like, you have, like, the ice fishing celebration in Wisconsin, Minnesota is unbelievable. So let's get back to waterfowl. I'm sorry.
Yep.
When you were saying that. But you're exactly right. I mean, you have got to be tough to hunt waterfowl in these conditions right now. Absolutely. And obviously, I saw Cree yesterday after hours coming up here in camouflage. He's out there. He's tougher than I thought for an attorney.
Yeah, he gets after it. So,
what you just said there is a whole lot of things that are going on to make when we set seasons and bags here in Pennsylvania. I mean, there's a lot that goes into it. There's a lot of research. And like you said, sometimes there is a little bit roll the dice on weather, and that's something that we can't control on that side of it. And, you know, I know guys that go out to the Dakotas and Minnesota and Wisconsin and Montana to waterfowl hunt. And, you know, basically they're flexing. And when they see fronts coming or whatever, that's when they're heading out there, and they have great hunts. But if they hit it wrong, you know, they might as well just go shoot clay birds, because it's the same no matter where you go. So let's talk about our current mallard populations and, you know, any concerns at this time and any efforts being made to, you know, further evaluate the mallard populations. Because when you talk about waterfowl, obviously, you know, when you were saying golden eyes and ringnecks, and, you know, let's think about a new waterfowler. Most of the time they think about mallards. And I think mallards are probably the most popular coast to coast, if I was to guess.
Yeah, they're generally speaking the most harvested bird in most every state. There's a few states, you know, like Florida probably, that doesn't shoot that many. But, it's...
just because we all shoot them before they get there, is that why?
They just don't make it there. Their population has been of concern recently. They've made about a 40% decline since the early 2000s. And because of that, a few years ago, we kicked that bag limit down to 2 a day. I think we'll see what happens there. We're working on improving those population models. I mentioned earlier, we're banning mallards in the postseason. That really improves our survival estimates, which we're kind of seeing some maybe declines in some survival, and particularly in juvenile birds. And so we want to improve those estimates with that. And then, we're looking at rolling out some research projects to better understand mallard reproduction and survival and movement and things like that.
We've been through this before, though, haven't we? I mean, is this like history repeating itself? Because I remember in my early days, mm-hmm. As a teenager, hearing problems, and you guys are a lot younger than me, so you might not have. But I mean, I'm sure the research is. Have we ever seen a decline like this as a country, not just a state?
Yeah, so we've seen it in the prairies. Certainly, the mallard population in the prairies and the mid-continent really fluctuates with drought. But here in the Atlantic Flyway, I mean, mallards are, when Columbus got here, there probably weren't very many mallards in the Atlantic Flyway. That was kind of colonization by birds moving east, as well as we released a whole heck of a lot of birds throughout the Atlantic Flyway, including the Game Commission. We used to have game farms similar to the pheasants. Yeah, and we used to release a lot of mallards. Their populations haven't fluctuated as much. We don't go through those drought cycles that they do. This is something else. We can't, we've gone through a lot of different things of guesses and changes in habitat, and certainly there has been some. But from what we can tell, it's not at the scale that we would have expected. But so we're going to have to dig into it a little deeper and kind of see what's going on there. Well,
the good news is you're on it. And that's why we're here. I mean, that's why the Game Commission exists. And it's kind of like turkeys. We're under goal. And Mary Jo and her Ken and their crew just last week started putting transmitters on hens. And we're going to figure it out. So this is totally a suggestion. And I know, how important do you think it is at this time when you said your mallard limit is 2, and that includes mm-hmm. one hen, is that right?
There's been a little confusion on that. It isn't one drake and one hen. It's 2 mallards, of which one can be a hen. Yeah. And so.
So it's not one drake and one can be a hen. Explain that one.
Well, it's just, you can shoot 2 drakes, or you can shoot a drake and a hen. You can't shoot 2 hens.
Right.
I've actually heard of a few hunters that thought that you could shoot 1 drake and 1 hen. That was the bag limit. So, yeah, just to clarify.
Gotcha. Okay. So let's talk about that. And this is more what I've grown up around. And like, how important you think it is as hunters, as conservationists, to try to shoot greenheads only? I mean, as a suggestion.
Yeah. I mean, I certainly think 2 greenheads looks nicer in a picture. From what we see, harvest can drive populations. Harvest does have an impact, but we don't typically see, they're the only ones with a sex-specific bag limit. It's kind of, if a guy wants to try and shoot only drakes, that's great. But I don't know that if everybody went out and just intentionally shot a hen that we would see massive population declines either. So
that's great. That's awesome. Because we don't want to discourage people from trying waterfowl hunting. So that's awesome. Awesome info. That's what we're here for. I mean, this has been eye-opening to me so far. And we got a little more to go yet. But
yeah,
let's talk about, like you said, the kind of the granddaddy here. Let's talk about the Canada goose, or as a lot of people say, Canadian goose. And I know anybody that's a waterfowler, because I've gotten scolded my early days when I went to work at Zinc Calls, which was a waterfowl company, and I'd come in and like, it's not a Canadian goose, it's a Canada goose. So explain that first to people that might not know. I know you diehard waterfowlers, I'm sorry. This is for people that that say Canadian goose. I want to get that explanation.
Yeah. The name is just Canada goose. I guess if you knew it was from Canada, you could call it a Canadian goose. But it
could be a Florida goose.
Yeah, I mean, could be.
But
I would say the majority of, with the exception of in our AP zone, the majority of the birds are pretty much Pennsylvania born and raised birds.
They're Pennsylvania Canada geese.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, got it. We got the definition right there. So they're Canada goose or Canada geese. There we go. Let's talk about those populations. And, you know, obviously the AP, the zone changes, and the one bird this year. Was it this year that happened, correct?
Yep.
Let's talk about why that happened and where we're at today.
Yeah, this one has given a lot of people a lot of heartburn, and I can't really blame them. But
the great thing about a podcast is people can't throw stuff at us right now.
Yeah, so. Yeah, no, it is. You know, it's that AP population, they breed up in the Ungava Peninsula, so it's way up there, northern, up in northern Quebec. And so whether it's on the Hudson Bay side of the peninsula or on the Ungava side of the peninsula, and that population has been just kind of in this weird weather cycle the last probably decade of really cold winters hanging on really late. One year, they basically had a complete breeding failure. 2018, they went up there. You know, they breed in early July up there, and they were basically standing on snow. They get a lot of snow. It melts really late. It was really cold. And those birds, yeah, I think they banded one juvenile of 3,000 birds that they banded up there that year. And so, yeah, because of that, because they migrate, so they're more vulnerable to harvest because, you know, a resident goose knows what hunting pressure looks like. A migratory goose has to kind of remember it every year. They can't sustain the harvest rates that we have on our RP geese. You know, our RP geese, we're up over 20% harvest rate. AP geese, we're looking at trying to target, you know, 2-3% harvest rates. We don't want to shoot very many of these birds because they just can't. They're not near as productive.
Just in case some RP's resident population.
Yeah, sorry.
Yep. No, you're good. You're good. And AP is the Atlantic population, which would correct. Be the migrators.
Correct.
Okay.
Yep. So, and that doesn't
I learned that today, too. I just figured it out, which I'm not that smart, but I did get that.
And that doesn't mean that there aren't RP geese in the AP zone. And that, in fact, it's probably our largest population of RP geese, which is what causes so many people so much heartburn. Mm-hmm. You know, they drive around Berks County, Lancaster County, and see all those geese. And it's like, man, I don't understand why I can only shoot one of these a day. But that's why we have the liberal bag limits in September, so mm-hmm. that guys can get after those birds. But you can't, even in hand, you would struggle between an average size, telling an average size RP goose from an average size AP goose. They're a little bit smaller. They have a little bit different dimensions on their bill. But
can you look at one and see it right away?
Not all of them.
See, that's a great thing. Yeah, because you've had your hands on more than anybody in the state. So.
Well, yeah, there's a few people that have probably handled more Canada geese in the state than I have.
Okay.
But, yeah, I mean, there's some really small AP Canada geese that you could pick out of a flock and be like, yeah, that's an AP Canada goose.
I know Tyler's not on that list. He's a waterfowler. He shot one goose this year. Oh, no geese.
Well, yeah, it's...
He sucks.
But, yeah... So because of that, because we can't do that, we can't do what Oregon did and have guys coming in and having to check their geese and comparing the colors to a soil chart, you know, color chart. We can't do that. And so the best way to protect those birds is to really reduce those bag limits and, you know, give them a chance to come back. So we're going to be in that again next year. Hopefully we can get up there. We can get some surveys done. We can get some banding done. Our models right now, last year said it should have been a decent reproduction year the last couple of years. So maybe we'll see these birds come back a little bit. And maybe we can get out of that and get into a little bit more liberal frameworks. But
I think a lot of population, you know, I'm going to go to turkeys again. You know, I've seen Texas where the population was extremely good. Well, and they go through a drought and they don't and breeding failure. Mm-hmm. And, you know, here the weather patterns for the last decade have been very wet and mm-hmm. we've had low reproduction across the state on wild turkeys. So we always have to watch that. And as hunters are, you know, folks that are really, when you watch those breeding seasons and you watch the nesting seasons and you watch when the little ones start to hatch, that's where we have to all get more educated and learn more. And the reason why we're at one bird limit in the migrating on the migrators and I mean, that was great. I didn't realize that the majority of our geese, even in that late season, are resident birds. I didn't know that. So.
Yeah, I mean, we see some birds pushing from New York. You know, I see the band reports coming in. They come in quarterly. And, yeah, we see birds push in from those places that are really frozen up. But even in the AP zone, we certainly are seeing more and more of those APs. I mean, it's probably still the majority are RP birds hanging around, but there's quite a few APs, and they're pretty vulnerable to decoying and harvest. Mm. And so I think they're generally a little more accessible, and that's when guys probably don't even realize that when they're wanting to get after birds in that later season, the reason these flocks are cooperating so well is maybe they haven't been sitting in the same pond for the last, 6 months.
Sure.
So.
Well, the other thing, and pressure is something that a lot of folks don't realize that happens. I watch it at my little place over across the river all the time, where I have deer all summer around, and all of a sudden people start bow hunting, and then I don't have any deer around. And it isn't because they're shooting them. It's because those animals out there are survivalists, and waterfowl being the same thing. You shoot at a flock of geese one time or two times in a field, they're not coming back. I mean, think about it. Well, I wouldn't either. I mean, go to get dinner at McDonald's or down the street and somebody's, firing at me. I'm not going back there too many times. I mean, it's just common sense. And I'm sure geese and ducks or anything are like any other wild animal out there. They're survivalists. Everything out there is trying to make them dinner at some point in their life.
Yep. Well, and we hear from a lot of guys, the week after season closes. Oh, look, the ducks just showed up. Like, we needed an extra week. It's like, well, it doesn't take very long for a duck to go from, those really secretive ways, finding those hidden corners and stuff like that, to realizing there's no more guns chasing them.
I think the old saying is that turkeys and deer, they have a wristwatch. They know when season's over, because the next day you start hearing them gobble or you start seeing deer around when season goes out.
Yep.
So, absolutely. So, we do have a couple really unique opportunities as well here in Pennsylvania for waterfowlers, whether you want to look at them or you want to hunt them or you just want to even learn more. And they're kind of on opposite end of the states. And if we could just talk about Middle Creek and Pimentuning real quick. And personally, I've duck hunted very few times in my life, but I try to put in for a blind every year at Middle Creek. It's a great experience. Take my daughter. We sit there. We have fun. We try to figure out what kind of ducks are coming in, and none of us are ever right, but we'll talk about that in a second. But just let's hit on that real quick.
Yeah, so we have both of them have kind of controlled goose hunts as well as controlled duck hunts in somewhat different capacities, but guys can put in September, and then there's the opportunities to put in during the season, either in Pimentuning, you show up at the door and see if you get drawn, or Middle Creek does the week ahead of time now, where they're doing everything online. And who knows, there may be some other changes that happen between now and next season. So I don't want to,
you're not letting the cats out of the bag.
If something changes between now and then, don't shoot the messenger that I was telling me I was wrong.
Well, all the information's on our website.
At
pgc.gov, and we can, and they stay updated on an annual basis. But just a little bit, taking it down a level. Let's say you're a new duck hunter or a new waterfowler. What is, in your opinion, the best way, other than going out there and with of learning the information or the best information out there on waterfowl identification? If you were a brand new waterfowler, what would give them a good recommendation on that?
Delta Waterfowl makes a really nice ID guide. I'd look at that. There's plenty of ID guides out there, but Delta makes a really nice one. You can look at bills and wings and stuff like that. If you have the ability, going out and finding a mentor of some sort, that's really the way to go. And, for a long time, waterfowl biologists, we kind of looked at waterfowl hunting as maybe like a gateway sport, something that somebody could just jump into. And it's difficult enough that if you found somebody who could really help you and help you figure it out, it make that learning curve a whole heck of a lot less steep.
And
so
it is a little more social than a lot of activities, so you can learn. And that's, for me, the hardest thing. I can't tell what kind of duck's in the air, and I try. I have to go with somebody that knows what they're looking at. And it's awesome. Like that, I'm sure you and Tyler both, you can see something out there flying as far as your eye can see, and like, that's a wood duck. Like, how do you know that? Well, then You know, you go in the, but I think that's one of the keys to a new waterfowler is to get out there. Like you said, Delta has a great identification. And then when you're driving down the road and you see some, you practice at it. Yeah. I mean, that's awesome.
Well, and I was going to say that springtime when all the birds are in breeding plumage, that's a great time to just get out, watch birds fly around, see if you can figure it out, and then wait till they land and pull out your pair of binoculars and see if you were right. And just try that a few times. You know, we're going to have, I mean, our two most prevalent ducks, we have them breeding across the state that time of the year, and wood ducks and mallards, like, that you'll get a lot of good practice if you just make an effort at it. You know, Middle Creek's a great place to go see it. Pima Tuning's a great place to go see it. Just go check them out and watch birds fly around and just practice. That's the best way to do it. Don't wait until you have a shotgun in hand.
That's right.
You're guessing, you know, with a two-bird mallard bag limit in one hand.
That's right. So let's just talk about, maybe you have a little bit of land, maybe you have 5 or some acres and you might have some wetlands on there. Is there things that private landowners can do to help their habitat? Just simple things, or people to contact or anything like that that could, if you have an interest in that, is that?
Yeah, there's a few. NRCS is probably the people to reach out to. They're going to have the most access to some of the different programs that might be available. You know, throwing up a wood duck box or a mallard nesting tube, if you're so inclined, you know, wouldn't be a terrible thing to do. And just, every wetland's so different, it'd be tough to make a recommendation beyond that. But, yeah, reaching out to those folks and just seeing what people think. You know, depending on what you have, we have Ducks Unlimited in the state as well, and they do lots of work, and so they might be able to help you as well, depending, you know.
And even if somebody throws up a wood duck box, it can help. I mean, and we have those here at the Game Commission too, and I'm not trying to sell, but we do it for a reason. We use our own wood duck boxes in state game lands across the state.
Yep.
And I looked at the numbers yesterday. We put a lot of them out there, so.
Oh, yeah. Yep, definitely.
Well, Nate, we surely appreciate you joining us this morning, and we're going to get back. We'll revisit waterfowl here before next hunting season, but anything else that you'd like to add before we head out there and have to get to our real job and not have so much fun this morning talking about waterfowl?
I don't have anything in particular, no. I just appreciate being on here, and as we get into season setting, if people have, you know, comments and questions, yeah, make sure to – all that information will be on the website, and make sure to comment. I can't tell you why we're doing things the way we're doing unless you ask the question. And I'm usually pretty willing to ask the question if you ask it nicely. So
yeah. Nice. Well, that's good. And you know, we are out there, and I know the folks that have contacted you to ask those questions. You've been awesome at getting back to them and helping folks understand. Again, we're all in this together. But Nate, thank you so much, and we enjoyed it. And we'll get back to you right here before waterfowl season on another episode of Call the Outdoors, and maybe we'll bring some duck calls or something and have a little of that kind of fun.
Yeah, 10-4.
Thank you, buddy.
Yeah, thanks.
On behalf of the Pennsylvania Game Commission, thank you for tuning in, and we hope that every day of field is filled with memories to last a lifetime. We're committed to leave conservation and wildlife better for the future, and we hope you can tune in next time to the PGC's Call of the Outdoors.